Well, good evening. I was just informed it was Dave WB the Third's birthday yesterday. Now, I don't know why they wait for me to get up here to tell me these things. But I will now lead us in happy birthday. Anybody else? Who are we pointing to? Kevin? No. Miley. Oh! I couldn't see her because she was sunken so far down into her chair. There she is. Okay. Happy birthday. God bless you. Dave WB and Miley. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. God bless you. Happy birthday to you. Very fun. Micah chapter 5. We'll do the whole chapter. Most of us familiar with Micah chapter 5 verse 2. I don't know. I'm just gonna say a very fitting time. You know, but Kevin just led his class on how it isn't Jesus' birthday, so. we'll look at it anyway. Micah chapter 5, excuse me, like I said, we'll go through the whole chapter. I'm not going to read it all in opening here, so let's just jump on in. I spoke to the context of the prophet Micah last week, so hopefully you remember some of that. Lots of woes issued out to God's people, to the nations, coming judgment, and in chapter 5 here, getting close to wrapping it up, we'll start in verse 1. Now muster yourselves in troops, daughter of troops. They have laid siege against us. With a rod they will smite the judge of Israel on the cheek. So first thing we want to think about is, why is the nation of Israel being addressed as the daughter of troops? Just, I guess, one noticed that. Okay. What do troops do? March? Where are they marching to? To battle, right? So Israel is being addressed as daughter of troops because they all need to be prepared for battle. All right, and in the immediate context, it's not for spiritual warfare, like I would encourage you guys. It's because, well, their neighboring enemies have been waging war against them, and that's at God's will. He has brought about the neighboring nations to bring about punishment on faithless Israel. They're being described as a city under attack, says they've laid siege against us. And I guess what I wanted just to note here, I'm not going to make it this 40 minutes without water, by the way. So, Mrs. Toole, if you can hear me. Yeah, thanks, Kevin. Although we understand well why Jerusalem is under attack, it is sad to see just how far they have fallen. All right? If we remember some of the first prophecies of the throne of David being established forever in Samuel. I mean, we have gone from the throne of David will be established forever to the nations crumbling. Thanks, Damien. That's a good job for you. I said, yeah. And I want us to see here in verse 1. They've laid siege against us. With a rod, they will smite the judge of Israel on the cheek. The king is supposed to hold that position. All right. So you have, okay, you know, city's under attack. And they've laid siege against us, but they're coming after the king. Like, it's the king that's getting struck down, too. All right. And kings are supposed to be the ones who are powerful and wise and protectors, right? They're the ones who have the wisdom to build a defense and an army and can say, we will withstand this siege. But notice it's the one, it's the leader, it's the ruler, the judge of Israel that gets the smack, okay? And You know, if you look at the history of Israel and Judah, that's kind of how it goes. You know, these guys, you know, they're getting ripped apart and their heads are getting cut off. And it's because they lacked good leadership. And so the nation struggled because of their poor leadership. Just see how far we've fallen from the throne being established to it being struck by its enemies. Verse 2, he says, "But as for you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you one will go forth for me to be ruler in Israel. His goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity." Matthew quotes this, and we'll look at that shortly. But what we see here, and the Jewish people certainly agreed, and the Holy Spirit will as well under the New Testament, is that this is letting us know where the coming ruler of Israel would be from. This is messianic prophecy study. This is a prophecy of the Messiah because the New Testament is going to attribute this verse to Jesus. Okay? So, yeah, really cool verse. I actually forgot to do the legwork on this, but the specific city that Jesus would be born in is being prophesied 700 years before his birth. So, that, I mean, that's amazing. If we were trying to nail down 700 years from now, where's the president of the United States going to be born from? Like, we would not succeed in that endeavor. All right. And we don't even know if there will be presidents in 700 years. Okay? So, very specific prophecy. And as we've been seeing, as we've been going through this study, the prophecies have started somewhat, I don't want to say vague, but not like not super descriptive to being like really, really descriptive to the specific city that Jesus would be born from. This prophecy is particularly exciting to me because of how precise it is. You know, and maybe you've heard this before, but, you know, in the proof study with people, I've told them, you know, hey, like if the Bible can, you know, predict the future and it comes true, I mean, that's proof of divine authorship. And I've heard a few times, well, other people have predicted the future and got it right. You ever heard about those guys, those gals? Okay, I hear about them all the time. But when you really start to get down to it, they were either right a couple times and wrong a bunch of other times. Okay, or the thing that they were predicting was, I mean, hey we could have done that. It's like, you know, this person will come, they're about yay tall, about yay big, brownish, you know, brownish, blondish, bluish hair. It's like, well, that's as accurate as we're going to get. The Bible is specific. This is the town. So, you know, the one little nugget here, I mean, Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Like, wow. Okay, I just amazed you with the Bible's knowledge. Okay, we have covered this one, all right? But the one little nugget here that is kind of fun that maybe not all of us know about is this Ephrathah. What is Ephrathah? Why does it say this ruler would come from the clan of Judah, from a town called Bethlehem, and why does it include Ephrathah? Does anybody know what Ephrathah means? Does anybody know what Bethlehem means? Okay, Bethlehem means house of bread. What do you think is the significance? And I'm just thinking out loud here. What do you think the significance of house of bread? Like, why would that be a thing? Why would we name a city that? What does that communicate? This might... New Covenant? Absolutely. In an immediate sense, I kind of made this point a couple weeks ago, like most of us have food available to us, right? Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And we have time to snack and eat second dinner, in my case. Okay? My family is the one laughing back there because they know. And we actually have to like schedule time to not eat. You know, we're like, you know, on this Sunday of the month, we're just going to stop eating. Okay? That's because we have that much access to food. Like, that doesn't happen to us because we just don't have food. Okay? So a house of bread communicates plenty, like plentiful. It's like it's the house of bread. It's like we go there and there's food. Okay? Ephrathah means fruitful. Abundance, abundance. You know, it's like you got a vineyard. Is the thing fruitful, abundant, or is it not? All right? Ephratha means fruitful. So I don't know if there's any connection between house of bread and fruitful. I'm just saying both these terms kind of have a, there's plenty. There's an abundance. Okay, it's known as the house of bread because it's overflowing with bread. All right? So why Ephratha? Okay. I was expecting an answer. My TomTom is recalculating. Hold on. How do I want to do this? Let's go to Genesis 35. Yeah, this is the one I want. I think this comes up again later in Genesis, but it's just a retelling of this story. Genesis 35. Verse 16. So then they journeyed from Bethel. And when there was still some distance to go to Ephrath, okay, Rachel began to give birth and she suffered severe labor. So this is Benjamin's birth. All right. Now we remember that she dies giving birth to her boy. Now if we jump down to verse 19, it says Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath. And the parenthetical statement is, that is Bethlehem. One other verse in Ruth, we'll hit that here for a second. Just we can turn there. Ruth. Chapter 4. So, Ephratha is either going to be like a nickname for the city of Bethlehem, or it's going to be the name of a smaller region that Bethlehem was in. You know, from Genesis, I can't really gather anything else other than that. It just says we were all on our way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. So we just can see scripturally that this word Ephrath is just a word that's used interchangeably sort of with Bethlehem, whether it was a nickname for it or a more narrowed down region. You know, it's like if you're coming to America and you're like, we're going to the big sky state. You know, it's like, where are you going? Montana. Okay. It's a term that's used interchangeably with Montana. Ruth chapter 4, verse 11, says, all the people who are in the court, trying to settle the estate here, right? All the people who are in the court and the elders said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built the house of Israel, and may you achieve wealth in Ephrathah and become famous in Bethlehem. Okay. So the terms used interchangeably there. So why is this important? Is anybody figuring out where I'm going now? I'm going to... Do you have something, Rain? You can yell it out. Okay. Okay. That isn't where I'm going. Okay, so that's kind of, that's, okay. Absolutely. And that's Kevin's comment earlier. What's the significance of Bethlehem, house of bread, new covenant, right? I'm trying to, that's a good point, Rain. I'm trying to show us something slightly different here. Let's go to Joshua. Maybe I just think this is just too cool, and maybe it's not. I don't know. Sorry. Joshua, I got this one written down. 19. Let's look at verse 10 first. Joshua 19, verse 10. Now the third lot came up for the sons of Zebulun. Okay, so we're talking about the allotment to Jacob's sons. And Zebulun comes up. According to their families, the territory of their inheritance. So now we get through here. Look in verse, their borders went up west. Okay, verse 12, turned from Sarid to the east, right? Verse 13, continued eastward towards the sunrise. Like, we're literally getting the physical boundaries of Zebulun's inheritance, okay? Now, if you look in verse 15, included also were Katah and Nahalal and Shimron and Idalah and Bethlehem. 12 cities with their villages. Bethlehem was a city in the region of Zebulun. But didn't our prophecy say that come from the clans of Judah? So, now I need an answer here now, because I've done the heavy lifting here. Is Bethlehem in Zebulun or in Judah? Say yes. Is Bethlehem in Zebulun or in Judah?
Yes.
What does that mean? There's two. Okay. Now, maybe that's the little nugget that not all of us knew. Now, why do I think this is so cool? Because what I hope we're seeing and what I hope we're excited about is how specific these messianic prophecies are getting. And then God narrows down the birth of the king, the Messiah, to the city he would be born in. And guess what? There's two. So what did that do to his odds? It doubled them, right? No. He told us it would be Ephrathah, the one that tells us geographically is the Bethlehem in Judah and not the Bethlehem in Zebulun. Okay, so I must have liked that one more than you guys. But, I mean, you just see, like, you know, God's given us all these messianic prophecies and they're specific, but he tells us exactly which one. Which for me is exciting because he's leaving no room for error so that we can have faith. You know, when I first saw this, I was like, oh man, there's two of them. And he just doesn't throw out the name Bethlehem. He lets us know exactly which one it'd be from. And then, okay, so let's get back to Micah here. That's Malachi. Okay, and then he says, too little to be among the clans of Judah. Now, that's significant. The town was small, all right? Could the mighty ruler really come from such a place? You know, it's interesting. You know, you think about it, too. I think I just read recently that there is 8 to 9 million people in New York City. There's something like 300 to 350 American cities that have a population greater than Billings. And what is that? At least a couple dozen cities that have a bigger population than our entire state. Okay? So Montana's small. All right? So let's say we're trying to pick, you know, 700 years from now, the president of the United States is going to be from... Which city are you going to go with? Dillon, Montana, or New York? See, I mean, I to some degree, it does even lend more credit to God, right? That he knew this ahead of time, because on top of the odds of picking the city, I mean, he picked a small one, a little one. But it's also significant because it's not so much this attitude, can anything good come out of Nazareth? It's so much that it, like, Bethlehem was a small town. You know, there was this... I'm losing his name, but there's this guy that used to come to the gym, and he was amazing because of just how strong of an athlete he was, but he was also really quick. And I remember talking to him one time. He's like, well, I actually played for the New York Jets. I was like, wow, that's a pretty talented dude. He's like, yeah, I'm from Dillon, Montana. I was like, some little guy from Dillon, Montana made it to the NFL? Like, that's kind of part of that story, you know? You're like, okay. Football players come out of Ohio, California, and Florida, all right? And then you hear that story about that Dillon, Montana boy made it to the end. Like, that's a big story, right? You can imagine the Dillon papers printing that one every month, you know. Somebody made it, okay? But but it's the Jets. It's the NFL, man.
Soon to be Jets.
Yeah, soon to be.
Two guys from Dillon.
Who's the other guy? Oh, Soon to be. Gotcha. He's from Dillon, too. Man, Dillon. In the NFL? Oh, Montana. Okay, well, this illustration is no good. Okay, California, Texas, Florida, and Montana produces football talent. Where's all the football players in our assembly then? What's going on? Okay. But, there was a little bit of that attitude there. It's like that, I mean, he even says, I mean, it's even, I just want us to see that it's embedded in the prophecy. Your ruler is going to come Bethlehem, and yeah, I get it, it's small. But a mighty one will come from something that is small. okay, let's see, yeah. Yes.
And who came from there?
Yes.
And who would be considered, you know, in a physical sense, equally mighty of a ruler as Jesus was reported to be?
Are you saying, did the people know that their Messiah would come from Bethlehem?
No. Knowing, you talk about Bethlehem being a small city.
Yes.
But King David also came from there.
Mm-hmm.
And he is very...
Yeah. Pretty fitting that he's a foreshadowing type of the Christ, right?
Exactly.
Exactly. David was also a shepherd.
Yes.
Okay, that shows up in our prophecy. Yeah, absolutely. So, comment or question?
Well, I guess just a comment. It's,
yeah.
I guess, or did they don't, a lot of people didn't apparently see the significance of that. They, who could come out of Bethlehem? Well, you're one of the greatest kings in the history of the people.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, it's not all that surprising.
I don't think it's necessarily surprising. I'm just saying it's embedded in the prophecy.
Well, yeah.
In our culture, we would be like, wow, look at this mighty thing coming from something that's so small. But that's just how God works, is he always takes something that's small. I mean, he was the sprout, right? Jesus was this tiny little sprout stemming off the end of a stump, and then it grows into this mighty tree that really does fill the whole world. So I'm just showing us, like, that works kind of against our thinking, the way we think. You know, we're like, how did this Dillon football player make it to the NFL? Now we got two of them, and now we're all amazed because there's four of them from Montana. We're like, oh, ha, ha, because that's our culture. This is how God works. He takes things. Yeah, I appreciate your comment. He takes things that are small, and he makes them great. Yeah. And, of course, you know, we also know from Isaiah that there wasn't going to be anything that would draw men, you know, to Jesus. You know, I mean, if you got see for some big hotshot town with a name behind you, you know, I mean, that's just not how God operates. So, yeah. Yeah, but just want us to see. I mean, he specifically points out, like, I understand, too little to be among the clans of Judah. It's like when they do their census, there's like, where's Bethlehem? Like, did the representative show up? Like, where? Like, it's little, okay? Easy to look over, okay? Well, the world looked over Jesus because it didn't seem significant. Okay, but he is mighty. Okay, this is quoted in Matthew chapter 2. Let's head on over there. Okay, it's going to be in verse 6. Herod hears the talk of a king being born. When he hears this in verse 3, he's troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Gathering together all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They said to him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for this is what's been written. And you, Bethlehem, land of Judah, by no means least among the leaders of Judah, for forth come from out of you shall come forth a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. So there's our prophecy being confirmed in the Gospel of Matthew under inspiration that this is certainly talking about Jesus the Christ. I guess while we're here, John chapter 7, again, just to further show us that the people did understand that the Messiah would be from from Jerusalem, Bethlehem. You know, Jesus is talking about from his innermost beings will flow rivers of living water. In verse 40, it says, some of the people, therefore, when they heard these words, were saying, this certainly is the prophet. Probably a reference to Deuteronomy. Others were saying, this is the Christ. Still others were saying, surely the Christ is not going to come from Galilee, is he? Has not the scripture said that the Christ would come from the descent of David? There's the connection to David. And from Bethlehem, the village where David was. Okay. Not entirely sure what happened there, because we also understand that, you know, Nicodemus gets into it with the boys. And, you know, the rulers are like, okay, what's up, Nick? Like, Are you trying to be this guy's disciple? And they go and say, go and search the scriptures and make sure that no prophet arises out of Galilee. They understood clearly because he was raised in Capernaum and raised in Nazareth and spent a large amount of time in Capernaum that he was from Galilee, but maybe they didn't hear where he was born. I don't know. They associated Galilee with him because he was raised there. But Jesus was born in Bethlehem, and the people understood that. They're trying to figure out, like, Jesus is this great prophet that's prophesied of. Surely it's him. He's the Messiah. But the guys from Galilee, we thought the prophet came from Bethlehem. So the people understood and attributed Matthew chapter 5 to messianic interpretation. And then the other thing we see here from the prophecy in verse 2, we are going to make it through this chapter. The brunt of this is in the beginning. So he's going to come forth for God to be ruler in Israel. Okay? This is God's will. Jesus came to do God's will. It's for him. He will come forth from me to be ruler in Jerusalem. And his goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity. Clearly deity type language. Right? Like, who else gets to say I've been around from the beginning? Unless it's God. Right? So we see that the Messiah is God. We don't have to spend a ton of time on this. His going forth. Or the literal is his appearances, which is cool about that verse there. Can be translated his going forth are from long ago, or it could actually be translated, and maybe some of you guys have this, I don't know. His appearances are from long ago. Well, that's kind of cool. You know, Jesus made plenty of appearances before his earthly ministry. Okay? His goings forth, his appearances have been from long ago. You know, there's a lot that we could cover here. We understand that Jesus the Messiah is the one who is and who was and who is to come, is the title he's given in the book of Revelation. All right, so he's just always been. Pause here for a moment. Any comments or questions on the first two verses? Kevin's got one, and then where else? Okay.
Sometimes people run over the language there in verse 2 and don't understand the thrust it would have. If you know the history of the people, the Israelite people at this time, it says that he's going to be born basically in Bethlehem or Ephrathah from Judah. Yet he's going to be a ruler in Israel.
Right.
And at this time you have the southern kingdom and the northern kingdom. Mm-hmm. So in that is a veiled reference that there's going to be a united people once again.
Yeah. And you'll actually see from here on out, chronologically, as you go through the prophets, that Judah just takes on the name Israel. Just once Israel's gone at the hand of the Assyrians, the prophetic language from the prophets, Judah just takes on the name Israel. You'll actually see that. So, any other thoughts, comments, questions? Yeah. Okay, verse 3, therefore, he will give them up until the time when she who is in labor has borne a child. Then the remainder of his brethren will return to the sons of Israel. So we got this picture of this remnant and this scattering again, right? That at the right time, the remainder of his brethren will return. The sons of Israel will return. Well, if they had to return, then they were gone. Right? Just lets us know that Israel would be given up until the time of Jesus. We'll get into this a little bit more, but that certainly is how it goes down historically. Okay? God endures the nation of Israel and Judah for a really, really long time, and then eventually there's a period that comes when he just allows them to go away at the hands of their oppressors. And then from that point on, they're always subjected to another nation. You know, you read 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 2 Samuel, you know, Israel's on top of the world, right? I mean, it's kind of a rocky road, but at least they govern themselves. At least they're winning battles against Edom and the Philistines and Syrians and, you know, but from this time forward, when this prophecy is made, until the coming of Jesus, God's people were always subjected to another nation. So they were given up. Okay, so he says, he will give them up until the time the child is born. Clear language we remember from Isaiah chapter 7, right? Child will be born, son will be given. Should call his name Emmanuel. Be born to the virgin. Like, so we can see that this is going to be fulfilled when Jesus comes. have us go to John chapter 8 just to further communicate this point. And I always found John chapter 8 to be, interesting is the word we use around here. But what nation took out the northern 10 tribes of Israel? Yell it out. Not from the front. Assyrians, okay? Who's credited with taking out Judah and deporting them? Babylon. Who's credited with taking out the Babylonians? Just picture your Daniel stature here and just start going from head to toe. Huh? The Persians. Persians. Who's after them? Okay, who's after them? Did we say Greeks? We said Greeks. Who are the legs of iron? Okay, what do all of those have in common with each other? They all ruled over the nation of Israel. All of them. So God allows his people to survive because he needs one. He needs, because did you notice there in verse 3, it said he would gather his brethren, the Messiah would gather his brethren. So the initial fulfillment is his people, right? Now we know that those who are the household of faith are God's children, right? But there's an immediate fulfillment of this where the gospel goes to the Jew, right? How many times does Romans say to the Jew first and then also to the Gentile? Twice in the same chapter, okay? So that's how God set this up. He's going to gather his people, all right? Now, so God allows his people to exist so that Jesus could be born of woman under the law as an Israelite, okay? But so they survived, but their survival was always being subjected under other nations, Assyria, the Egyptians, actually, for a period of time, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans. Okay, so this prophecy is very specific that from that time they would be given up by God and they would be ruled by others until Jesus came. All right. Now I find John 8 interesting because Jesus says anybody who commits sin is a slave of sin. Okay? And they're like, you know, in verse 33, they answered him, "We're Abraham's descendants." They got that part right. "He have never yet been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say we will become free?" It's like, I don't get it. Okay. Their answer to Jesus is, well, it's an arrogant one. "We are Abraham's descendants. We have not ever been enslaved to anybody else. Why are you telling us we need to be free?" Do I need to go through the list again? The Assyrians, the Egyptians, the Babylonians, okay? The Persians, the Greeks, the Romans. The one thing they all have in common is they ruled over God's people. Okay, so he, like I mentioned earlier, he does gather the remainder of his brethren. There's many things we could talk about that. Clearly a reference to the scattered Israelites, but has its ultimate fulfillment in the household of God. We can head back to Micah. Hopefully, I've actually preached a couple messages and a family camp message on this before. But Hebrews says it's the household of faith that Jesus is not afraid to call his brethren. Okay, and in the context there of Hebrews chapter 2, he quotes Isaiah 8. He says, "I and the children who have given me are for signs and wonders in Israel." Okay, so what he's saying there is Jesus has no problem attributing himself to his people as his brother, which comes out in this prophecy. But the New Testament tells us that it's the household of faith that he's not afraid to call his brethren, and the household of faith are comprised with those who do his will. All right. So certainly Micah chapter 5 has strong language for the physical nation of Israel. Those Jews being gathered in first, absolutely. Okay, but the New Testament would further go on to tell us that the ultimate gathering are from the Jews, those who would obey the gospel of Jesus Christ. Verse 4, "And he will arise and shepherd his flock." That's not a new theme in our study here. He would be a shepherd. "In the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord is God, and they will remain, because at that time he will be great to the ends of the earth." Pretty straight language. I just want us to see that we started this section with Gather up the troops, prepare yourself for battle, and oh, by the way, the king's the one that's going to get the licking, along with the people. Well, that only happens if the king's weak. Two, this is how it's going to be until Jesus comes. And by the way, he will be a strong shepherd of God for his people. Okay, just notice the contrast there. That he would be a good shepherd in the strength of Yahweh. A strong, good leader. Talk a little bit about David. Certainly is appropriate. And then in verse 4, he says, they will remain. Okay, actually, the literal there is like remain. I don't know. It's like you put something there, and you know it's going to be there when you wake up in the morning, right? Yeah, you left something outside, and you don't know if it's going to be there the next day because someone's going to come and take it. Okay, so what's being communicated here is that when Jesus comes, he'll be the good shepherd. Nobody's stealing the sheep. They're safe. Or the other connotation is they will live forever. All right? And so we certainly see that in Christianity. It says there is now, therefore, no condemnation, right, for those who are in Christ Jesus. We who are faithful remain, right? Jesus actually goes on when he talks in John about being a good shepherd. He says, nobody can snatch them out of my hand. Okay, so all these things being fulfilled, spoken ahead of time. Verse 5, to this one will be our peace. So now we saw another... This letter written chronologically in the history of time was written, well, not written around, but in the same time of events as what other major prophet? Isaiah. Thanks, Jared. Isaiah. So it makes sense to us that some of these themes are going to be really, really similar, right? We already saw that the nation would be given up by God until the child was born. Well, as I already said that. Okay? And now Micah is telling us that he would be our peace. Well, Isaiah told us he'd be the Prince of Peace. Okay? So we've covered that. When the Assyrian invades our land, when he tramples on our citadels, then we will raise against him 7 shepherds and 8 leaders of men. I have the slightest clue who these leaders are. But what I do know is that 7 and 8 is just showing that there's plenty. Okay? I'm not sure how to explain this. Like, there are enough qualified, mighty leaders in this time to rise up to the challenge to lead the people against Assyria and to come out ahead. 7, maybe 8 is kind of the language there. All right? But this is where this gets, and I will gladly take your input because I'm not going to stand up here today and tell you that I have verses 5 and 6 figured out. Okay? And I always make sure to tell you guys that. So, okay. Well, let's finish reading this and then let's think about it for just a minute. When the Assyrian invades, and they do, and they trample on our cities, they do, we will raise up against him 7 shepherds and 8 leaders of men. Okay, so Israel's going to have leadership. All right. Then, it says, they will shepherd the land of Assyria with the sword. Okay, so if you have Assyrians in your citadels, and you're fighting back, and you're fighting back so much that these shepherds that you raised to fight back have pushed so far that now they're in Assyria's land, is the picture I get. Okay? The land of Nimrod at its entrances. So Nimrod started Babylon, right? Like he established the town Babel. Okay, you can read that in Genesis. So it's just another name for Babylon. And he will deliver us from the Assyrian when he attacks our land and when he tramples our territory. Okay, gladly take your input. But when I take this section and I put it up against the kings and Isaiah, I get a little bit of a blurred picture here because Assyria does come, and they do trample the citadels. They do wipe out the 10 northern tribes of Israel, and they do take out a large portion of Judah. Because if you remember, Assyria's conquest went all the way down into Egypt. You cannot go from Assyria to Egypt without traveling through Judah. So it wasn't like the Assyrians came down and were like, there's Israel, let's trample their citadels. There's Judah, let's skip their citadels. There's Egypt, let's trample their citadels. No, they trampled the citadels of Judah. The difference is they got to Jerusalem and that's where it stopped. Okay, because then you have King Hezekiah and his one of his moments of greatness. Okay, he goes on to blunder afterwards. Prays to God and says, deliver us from the hands of our enemies when they're taunting them at their gates. Saying, look, Jerusalem, you're going down. Every city we've come up against has fell at the hand of our army. You're going down now. Just give up. And they're out there mocking them. And Hezekiah convinces the people to trust the Lord. They pray to God, and God saves them. And one night, an angel of the Lord rescues them. Right? So what happens afterwards? Do the leaders of Jerusalem march a counterattack and push the Assyrian soldiers all the way back to Nimrod? No, Sennacherib goes home, licking his wounds. He just lost 185,000 soldiers in one night, right? So then Sennacherib goes home, and what does he do? Anybody remember? And now that I'm thinking about it, maybe that's how this is fulfilled. I don't know. He goes home and he just goes back to his pagan worship rituals. And then what happens? His boys lop off his head. They kill him and they take his empire. And that's the end of the story. So, I don't understand myself the language of how these rulers of Judah are going to go push into Nimrod and come back. The conclusion I come to is it just has to have a spiritual fulfillment. Look, a lot of these prophecies that we've gone through, okay, is there a physical gathering of the people of Israel and Judah after the Babylonian captivity? Yes. Have you read Ezra? Nehemiah? Right? Governor Zerubbabel? Like, the people came back together. So there, those who were scattered came back. And you have this small, small physical remnant of Israel, but it's a foreshadow of the church, right? So with so many of these prophecies, we do have an immediate fulfillment of them. And thank the Lord, right? Because he gives us something. Wait, it is 8 o'clock. He gives us something physical as a foreshadow and a type. I don't personally understand the foreshadow here. And type, I think it only has a spiritual fulfillment. Okay? Because Babylon represents the world, right? And when you're freed from the oppressor and ruler of Babylon, Satan, those gates get pushed where? All the way back to hell. And if we have the right mindset, Satan has to flee far from you. He cannot march into your citadels of your mind. He can't. You can resist him, and he will flee from you. So, we'll have to finish the last part of this next week. It goes really quick because the majority of the information was in verse 2. But we'll finish this one real quick and then maybe move to Habakkuk. I'm not sure yet. But I do want to leave time, just a minute here while we're grabbing the mic, for any closing comments on verses 5 and 6, because I basically just told you, I'm not going to stand in front of you and say I have that completely figured out, other than the conclusion I've arrived at is that its fulfillment is spiritual and spiritual only.
I think you've got it nailed. It goes back to Genesis 22 where God said, I'll bless you, greatly multiply your seed. Stars of heaven is the sandwich on the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. Yeah. And then Jesus said, the gates of Hades will not prevail against the church. So it's definitely spiritual.
And it started to click for me when you got, you know, Assyria's going on here and and Babylon as well. So that's where the Nimrod reference comes from. So you think Babylon's a reference of the world. He who is in you is greater than he who is in the world. It is all those New Testament references. Yeah. Any other thoughts? Yeah, go ahead.
And the other thing that's interesting about Sennacherib specifically is that he razed Babylon to the ground a couple of times.
Say that again?
He destroyed Babylon.
Yeah.
He raised it to the ground a couple of times, actually. So.
Yep. Yeah, he went home licking his wounds that day, and then he paid for it. Hey, well, thanks for your attention. I know that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, and I know that we know it. Hopefully the Ephrathah thing was maybe new for some of us. God is good. He's got this thing. He's got the whole world in his hands. Okay? And he's shown us that he knows what's going to happen ahead of time, and I just appreciate his willingness to be specific in his prophecies so that we might have faith.